This is Audible.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents Age and Guile, Beat Youth, Innocence, and a Bad Haircut by P.J. O'Rourke. Read by Rob McQuay.
Age and Guile, Beat Youth, Innocence, and a Bad Haircut. Introduction. There's a long-term problem with being a writer, and the problem is all the things that, over the long term, I've written. How would you like to have the twaddle and blather you talked 25 years ago preserved in detail, set down in black and white, and still extant someplace? I once had hoped that the fashion for recycling would rid me of my printed past, but what artisan, however modest his art, can bear to think that his life's work amounts to no more than the 1/100th part of the local Boy Scout paper drive? So there's still a pile of it in my attic. Sooner or later, somebody will find these manuscripts. I might as well publish them myself. Also, I'm being paid for it. The business of trading embarrassment for money is an old American custom dating back to the murky beginnings of the Phil Donahue Show. Examining these works, I see evidence that I was once younger than anyone has ever been, and on drugs. At least I hope I was on drugs. I'd hate to think that these were my sober and well-considered thoughts. It is, I guess, interesting to watch the leftist grub weaving itself into the pupa of satire, and then emerging a resplendent conservative blowfly. Also interesting is the career arc. I start out making cruel fun of a second-rate American president, and wind up making cruel fun of a second-rate American president. And that is all the interest I can summon. I wonder how many people in the so-called creative fields stand before their accumulated professional efforts and think that the thing they've been doing for the past quarter of a century is a thing for which they have no particular talent. Not enough, to judge by the too copious output of various mature painters, poets, and architects. Hardly ever do we hear these people exclaim, "My pictures don't look like anything," "My poems don't rhyme," or, "This isn't a building, it's the box a building comes in." Fortunately, I discovered journalism. Talent hasn't been a question since. But I didn't mean to be a journalist. I meant to be a genius. I was going to produce an oeuvre so brilliant, important, and deep that no one would ever understand it. Pooh on Finnegan's Wake! River run past Eve and Adams, from swerve of shore to bend of bay, brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation back to the Howth Castle and environs. Anybody can read that. Here's a line from a play I wrote in 1968. Viva, 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 viva. Viva, 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 viva. Viva, viva, viva. Unfortunately, I didn't have the knack for literature. It seemed that a certain number of English professors had to have written brilliant, important, and deep PhD dissertations on how no one would ever understand you. Also, it helped to be dead. To tell the truth, I didn't even mean to be a writer. I meant to be a race car driver, except I didn't have a race car. Or I meant to be a rock star, except I couldn't sing or play an instrument. I know, there are so many who haven't been stopped by that, but I was naive. Or I meant to be a soldier of fortune, except the entry-level job in that field was a stint in Vietnam, and, geez, they were actually shooting at you over there. What I meant not to be was just a college student, how bourgeois. I did spend the summer of 1966 working as a railroad brakeman, and that seemed to me to be the coolest job that a fellow who knew all the verses to If I Had a Hammer and Old Stewball could possibly have. I wanted to quit college and stay a brakeman forever. But this never seemed to happen to Neil Cassidy and Jack Kerouac. My mother wouldn't let me. So I had to find something I could be while also being a college student, and something that didn't require expensive equipment, difficult skills, or courage under fire. Writing was the obvious choice. I decided that I would, over the summer of 1967, write a novel. I wasn't sure how long something had to be before it was considered a novel, so I looked around for the briefest acceptable example of the type. I settled on Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray. In point of learning the craft, I would have been better off reading the book. Instead, I counted the words in it, multiplying the average per page by the total of pages to arrive at the figure 50,000, There were 130 days in my summer vacation. If I wrote 384 words a day, I would be within 80 words of a complete novel by fall. And so, every night after work, and every noontime when I got up on Saturdays and Sundays, I would sit down and write 384 words. Oh, sometimes it was 380 and sometimes 390, but usually I was pretty close to my mark. And in September, I indeed had something that was just awful. I have not been able to reread it, partly because of severe wincing, but partly because I couldn't type, and all 49,920 words are scrawled in longhand, also execrably spelled and punctuated with mad abandon. The text concerns, as much as I can determine or remember, being young in Ohio. Fair enough, since I'd never been anything other than young in Ohio, though I had visited Chicago and been to Florida twice. I believe the protagonist visits Chicago and goes to Florida twice. The problem with the book is that I saw being young in Ohio as a horror beyond telling, and my prose proved the case. When I got back to school in the fall, I gave my opus to Jerry Bovin, the only real writer I knew. Jerry, who appears as Gary Ballow in two of the stories in this book, hadn't actually published anything, but I could tell that Jerry was a real writer because, although he was not yet 30, he was already drinking himself to death. I still have some of Jerry's fragmentary manuscripts, and the sad truth is that he was a real writer. Indeed, he might have been another John Kennedy Toole if only he killed himself after he completed something instead of before. Jerry wrote a long critique, a largely charitable assessment in which he expounded upon the difficulties of the picaresque novel, the challenges of first-person narration, and the need for consistency in fictional point of view. He allowed that some of my characters were effective, was indulgent with my attempts at plot development, and even went so far as to say, "The thing as a whole is rather likable." But at the end of his commentary, he appended this postscript. "It has just occurred to me that there is, however, the dreadful possibility that your book is supposed to be serious." Juvenilia Delinquent, Underground Press, 1970 to 1972. I began to write for pay in the spring of 1970, albeit that pay was mostly peanut butter sandwiches and mattress space. The mattress was not very clean, but neither was I. This first place of employment was in Baltimore at a newspaper called Harry, which had been founded the year before by Michael Carliner, Thomas V. D'Antoni, and other members of Baltimore's hip scene, such as it was. Baltimore was a depressed and seedy industrial town, and the 60s never really caught on there. A bunch of young people who stayed high all day and weren't working didn't make a huge impression on a city full of unemployed drunks. Harry had a circulation of 6,000 or 8,000, and came out every so often. Our publication schedule was determined by marijuana. Either we printed an issue whenever we had marijuana, looking at old copies of Harry tends to confirm this, or we printed an issue whenever we ran out of marijuana and hence got bored with the peanut butter sandwiches and mattress space. I don't remember which. The odd moniker was chosen by a 2-year-old. In the spirit of the times, he was asked to name the newspaper. His grandfather was Harry, and the kid was calling everything Harry just then, and Harry it became. Oh, we were wild, creative, and free. Editorially, Harry was opposed to war and capitalism and wanted to replace these with loud music and drugs. Today, in America's inner cities, boombox-carrying crack sellers have accomplished this very thing. Harry was also in favor of love. Here, we staff members put our beliefs into practice. We didn't just talk about love, we did something about it. Unsatisfied with being mere journalistic observers, we became true activists, which was how the mattress got so dirty. Why I Invaded Cambodia, by Richard Milhouse Nixon, as told to P.J. O'Rourke. Harry, June, 1970. Author's Note. Richard Nixon did indeed go out at some ungodly hour to speak to anti-war demonstrators in Washington. According to an article by Robert B. Semple, Jr., in the May 10, 1970 New York Times, President Nixon left the White House shortly before dawn this morning, drove to the Lincoln Memorial, and spent an hour chatting with young people who had come to protest his war policies. The extraordinary visit, which caught his staff unawares and left the Secret Service petrified, was Mr. Nixon's first direct exchange with students massed here for a weekend of protest. As he stood on the steps of the memorial and talked, the crowd around him grew from 8 to 30 to 50. And near the end of what appears to have been more monologue than dialogue, he asked the students, quote, to try to understand what we are doing, end quote. To understand where I'm at, you've got to dig it that I've been into this very heavy political thing for a long time. In some ways, this has done strange things to my head, but I've always felt that when you're really into something, you shouldn't cop out on it. To be really out front, I get off on ego trips, power games. It's a speed freak sort of trip, I admit it, but, like, that's where I'm at. I mean, you can put me down for kicking your ass, but don't put me down for being an ass kicker, because that's my movie. That's cool. I got to do my thing. I just want to make that perfectly clear. I'd always been sort of into this kind of riff, but I never meant to get as strung out on it as I am now. It was in 52. I was out on the coast to get my head together when Ike calls me on the phone. Dickie, he said, you won't believe the job offer I have. Tell me, I said. Dickie, he said, they're going to make me president. Far fucking out, I said, but he sounded troubled. Dickie, he said, I'm troubled. What's the matter, Ike? I said. Dickie, he said, if someone were to find out, Time Magazine or someone, that all these years Mamie's been in drag... I told him about the operations in Sweden. I guess I could see I had my head together about politics, because several days later he called again and asked me to be vice president. I told him I wasn't up for that. I was just ready to split for Mexico City with Jack and Alan and Neil. But he came on strong and vibed me out about the whole thing. I've been into it ever since. So, like, one thing led to another, and I got to be president myself. Now being president is a really heavy thing. It's like being a very big dealer, like doing deals for 500 or 600 kilos every day, guns out on the table and briefcases full of $100 bills. You have to deal with really heavy cats. This redneck that held the job before me had some fucked up war going down. First thing I did was I called the Pentagon and said, this is the president. Off that shit. I want everybody back in California by Friday night. 15 minutes later, the chairman of the board from GM walks in with this weird cat in a sharkskin suit and sunglasses. Well, there's a time to stand and fight and a time to cut and run. Being president is a bummer. Not only heavy cats like that to hassle with all the time, but for a vice president, I get a yippy infiltrator who runs around the country saying the most outrageous possible things, trying to discredit the entire government. I was really getting freaked out. All these frustrations and anxieties building... bad vibes, like the Supreme Court. The whole country's making an ass of itself, pasting up American flags everywhere, shooting kids and spades, saying things like, leave loose the dogs of war. So I figure they must want a Nazi for their Supreme Court. Give them what they want, I say. Two Nazis I give them. But no, no, they don't want Nazis. They want a liberal. A liberal. There are only 11 liberals left in the United States. I had a hell of a time. Like I said, when I first got into this trip, I couldn't dig the war. But then I started to get to know Westmoreland and his buddies. They'd be walking up and down Pennsylvania Avenue wearing their colors and looking really bad. We got close. They're good guys once you can dig where they're at. I started going out on runs with them in their choppers drinking beer. When I got behind it, I understood they aren't really violent. They're for peace, love, and everything. They just like to stomp gooks. They gave me a set of honorary colors. A cut-off Eisenhower jacket with script lettering in an arch across the back saying, Joint Chiefs of Staff, with USA down at the bottom, and a big mushroom cloud in between. I got very tight with Westmoreland. Wes the Axe, so I laid it on him about the vice president and all that shit. Wes said, yeah, you gotta be a badass in this world, or you just ain't gonna make it. I thought about that. And when I found out Cambodia was hiding those gook Viet Cong, I said to myself, I'm going to trash that country. Jesus, I never thought anybody'd get all that uptight about it. But soon as I told Wes to do a number on the Cong, the shit really hit the fan. I felt bad about it. I really did. First thing you know, there are thousands of people planning to gather outside my house to vamp on me about it. Night before they were all to come, I dropped a tab of sunshine and thought it over. I went through some weird changes. Early in the morning, when I was coming down, I decided to go outside and rap on it. Hardly anybody was there, and I had to wake this cat up to find somebody to rap to.
"Wake up," I said. "I'm the president. Want to do some boo?"
"Oh, yeah, far out. Hey, Fat Freddy, wake up, it's the president."
"Abby?"
"No, no, their president."
"Oh, yeah, far out," said Fat Freddy.
So they got up and blew some of my dynamite Laotian shit, and I sniffed some coke they had and laid it on them, what I said here.
"Wow, man," said the first.
"Where's your head at?"
He told me my thing is really bad karma, that I'd be reincarnated as a Gila monster. I could dig what they were saying. That's the way people should be with each other, really out front. This is what America's about.
The Boxer Shorts Rebellion. An exclusive look at sex behind the bamboo curtain. Screw, March 1972. Author's note. The following was part of a semi-elaborate hoax wherein I claimed to have been a member of the press corps accompanying Richard Nixon on the epochal trip to China in February 1972. Poor Nixon seemed to possess some pheromonal lure for pests like me, which may explain Woodward, Bernstein, Deep Throat, and the whole Watergate imbroglio as well as anything does. The hoax began in an underground newspaper, the New York Ace, continued on radio station WBAI, then as now the voice of nonsense in Gotham, and culminated with this article for Screw. The original editor's note is attached. Nothing in it except available on 4 hours' notice was true. Interesting to note that, of the hundreds of publications founded in those exuberant days, only two, the self-explanatorily titled Screw and my current employer, the pop music journal Rolling Stone, still flourish. What does this say about the intellectual, moral, and artistic contributions of the 60s to present-day society? Practically everything. The China hoax fooled whole dozens of people, and Newsweek almost did a story on our hippie in Peking, except, for once, Newsweek checked its facts. When the penny dropped, some of my fellow lefty journalists were wroth.
"You're just lying to the people," said one.
"What's the point of this?" "I guess the point was that the press coverage of Nixon's China trip was so shallow and predictable you didn't need to be there to write it." How green I was to think this notable. P.J. O'Rourke was among the 87 newsmen who accompanied President Nixon to Peking. Representing the Syndicated Collegiate Press Service, SCPS, 24-year-old O'Rourke was the youngest member of the China Trip Press Corps, and the only one who, by any stretch of the imagination, could be deemed hip. His coverage of the Nixon junket has been syndicated to college and underground papers nationwide. PJ is a New York-based freelance writer who graduated from the University of Michigan with a degree in Chinese language and literature. His opportunity to go to Peking came as a result of the presidential press secretary Ron Ziegler's appointment of one representative from the collegiate press, Fay Levine, co-editor of the Harvard Crimson and SCPS Boston correspondent. But Fay, also a Chinese major, was hospitalized with hepatitis on the eve of Nixon's departure, and SCPS's editor-in-chief Ed Dale picked PJ as an 11th-hour replacement. Dale said he chose O'Rourke even though PJ is not a college student because he was the only young, experienced reporter we know who speaks Chinese and is available on 4 hours' notice. Unisex is the very first thing that hits you in China. Not that ersatz continental Gaussinette haircut business or high heels for men, but real unisex. The clothing that they wear, it's not masculine or feminine. Nor is it as dumpy and sexless as it looks in those daily news centerfolds. It's just the same, for everyone. Unisex. And the effect of those millions and millions dressed alike without regard for age or station is more spectacular than any Ken Russell costumed outrage. This is what they're talking about when they say culture shock. This is not what I expected it to be. I had this picture in my mind of the identical masses, lumpish, lumpen, flat-faced, neuter, homely, puritanical, and paramilitary. But Chinese clothes are too loose and wrinkled and casual to look military or like a uniform. There's an impression of comfort, not regimentation. The colors are all very quiet, gray, green, and blue, but faded with that washed-out look it takes us stateside hippies years to achieve in our jeans. Nothing flashy about these people, that's for sure, but right away that makes you look at their faces, look at them, not what they're wearing. And that's sexual in a subtle way, even erotic. They don't care much about clothes, wearing them with baggy disdain, not all bound up like a bunch of latent bondage freaks the way we do. And this does fantastic things for the Chinese women, really sets off their beauty. The same as when some girl puts on your old flannel shirt about 5 sizes too big. All the Chinese women look cute and scruffy like that. Also, I noticed right away that no one is wearing underwear. Those loose cotton pants are always molding themselves fluid-like around Chinese ass cheeks and draping with a sort of Spartan luxury into folds at the crotch. At the factories we visited, girls would be working away greasy and adorable and determined in the drafty shops, and nipples would raise welts in their khaki-worn shirts all around. I almost went mad with socialized lust. The Chinese are so pretty, small and lithe, fine-featured, not a wasted stroke. They made me feel clumsy and hatchet-faced, these unpainted beauties of the Orient, with their pert breasts and Lolita-slim hips. But it's all unisex, finally. So not just the girls, or even the handsome young people, but the unnumbered lot of them exude this sexuality, the body proper, naked and strong beneath the handiest and most democratic thing available to throw on the back. Of lewdness, on the other hand, there is nothing. There's no nightlife that I could detect. Liquor is sold in some stores, but there are no bars, much less nightclubs, fuck movies, sex shows, massage studios, or whorehouses. Nor are there any sex papers, sexy publications, or even cheesecake shots. The best I could do was a photo of some lady soldiers with their pants rolled up in the rice paddies in the Move Forward with Firm Determination Red Women's Brigade magazine. I tell you, I couldn't figure it out. Such sexy people and no visible sex. I was sure I just wasn't getting the full story. Our guides and translators weren't giving us much rope. They had an endless fucking itinerary planned, touring this communal bakery, that collective steel mill, and some other people's tractor assembly plant until I had buns, Bessemer, and detachable winch and stump-pulling units coming out of my ears. I tried putting the make on our head translator, but she immediately explained that she was going steady, literally, attached with progressive fervor, and showed me her boyfriend's Chairman Mao button. Now, how the hell she could tell it from her own Chairman Mao button is beyond me, but there it was, with some Angora wool wrapped around the back. That was the end of that. Back in the Hotel of the Nationalities, where the press party was housed, I had this young waiter on my floor. I could tell he really wanted to talk as soon as he found out I spoke Chinese, but the waiters weren't allowed any lengthy personal contact with us. Finally, the third night we were in Peking, when he brought the evening tea, I told him to tell the bell captain, or whomever, that the decadent American had got drunk and was sick all over the place, then come back to clean up so we could talk. He was leery, but agreed to try, and rushed back with a mop and 10 solid minutes of questions. He hoped one day to be a people's intelligence agent, he confided, and had to know about America in great detail. What was it like to ride in a Packard? Who was pitching this year for the Brooklyn Dodgers? Was Eddie Fisher still going with Elizabeth Taylor? What was Judy Garland's latest hit? My Chinese is not the best, but I answered him as well as I could, and then asked him about China. "Wow," I said, roughly translated. "Is everything as uptight as it looks?" He gave me one of those foreign devil stares. "You know," I said, "what's a fella to do for laughs around here?" He explained they had ping-pong matches every Sunday at the school where he went. All the girls and boys would go to the ping-pong game. I told him that wasn't what I meant. "Well," he said, "after the game, on the way home, sometimes girls will hug and kiss one in a spirit of revolutionary comradeship." He admitted, too, that you get bare tit that way sometimes, if you were resolute in proletarian unity. But progressive girls didn't do it until the imperialist running dog oppressor had been crushed, or they were married, whichever came first. There were some girls, though, who really put out. You could tell them because they'd kiss you after your first self-criticism and aloud reading from the thoughts of Chairman Mao's study group together. They were fast and usually wound up in homes for unwed revisionists. "Is there any prostitution in China?" He said, "No. That would be capitalist exploitation and bourgeois decadence." But he allowed us how there were some dirty acupuncture parlors. I asked about masturbation, and he explained that the Red Book was very clear on that point, that it caused Trotskyism and made warts grow on your chin. He had never heard of dry humping or hickeys. A mention of pornography, however, produced an enthusiastic response, and he pulled out of his wallet a faded and poorly reproduced playing card with a chubby peasant girl in the back. She was pulling up the front of her quilted jacket, and her entire stomach was exposed. After that, he had to leave. The only other people I really had a chance to talk to were some students at Peking University who were completely flabbergasted when questioned about deep or French kissing, and would only say that whenever they got hooligan urges, they took a cold shower. Myself, I'm not fooled. Such is the deceit for which the Orient is famed. We haven't been hearing about Oriental women for the past 35 years just because they build good tractors. My dad was in World War II, and I know. These Reds just know we're a bunch of regular softies for this wholesome hard work stuff. They're just making a play for our respect and admiration. You can't tell me they're a bunch of goody-two-shoes over there in China when we're not around to watch them. In the first place, there's so damn many of them. You don't find babies under cabbage leaves. And in the second place, the last day we were in Peking, when we were all visiting the Forbidden City, I was wandering around looking for a men's room in the Palace of Sublime Peace when I turned a corner and came upon Kissinger and Zhou Enlai embracing behind an ornate pillar. Kissinger kept wetting his little finger and twisting it in Zhou's ear while humming sotto voce, "Chinatown, my Chinatown." Zhou was smiling inscrutably. "Jets and sharks drop acid," read Marcuse. Harry, June 1970. Author's note. This was written shortly after the May 4, 1970, killing of four college students at Kent State University, and was the first of a series of addlepated rants. My old high school girlfriend was enrolled at Kent and was standing clueless in the crowd of demonstrators when the National Guard opened fire. Struggling against abstract injustice was one thing, but now I battled a ruling class power elite so depraved that it shot at Connie Nowakowski's adorable snub nose and cute butt. In time, my radical ardor would cool. I realized that the actual killing of senators, congressmen, presidents, and so forth, while doubtless a very good thing of its kind, would be a bad career move. I'd probably never win the Pulitzer Prize for addlepated rant, marry Connie Nowakowski, and turn Harry into a daily paper as big as the New York Times, only more influential. Then I got a job. It wasn't much of a job. I was a messenger. But it brought in $150 a week, and that was wealth as far as I was concerned. We were paid fortnightly. I waited greedily for my $300. But when my pay envelope arrived, I found, after federal, state, and city taxes had been deducted, and Social Security, health insurance, and pension plan payments had been made, only $160 was left. I began yelling, "I'm a revolutionary. I've been a revolutionary since I went to college. I demonstrated, I've rioted, I've done everything I could to overthrow capitalism. And what do I find when I get my first paycheck from a capitalist company? Communism." Of course, it was several years before the implications of what I yelled sank in. At that age, I wasn't listening to anyone, myself included. New tactics for new times in the belly of the pig. Time to abandon your bullshit liberal sensibilities and bring the revolution home. Us white child college kids got a lot to learn. No time left for pamphleting and leafletting, picketing and petitioning, talking and walking and shitting around. Time to trash the state. We've got a lot to learn. Armed love. We'll learn that armed, for us, implies love, and that love necessitates armed. If we don't learn how to fight, we won't win. If we don't learn how to keep our love in the nexus of that fight, we won't deserve to win. Forsake the old values we pretended to forsake before. Not only racism, capitalism, sexism, nationalism, but, as important, gratuitous hatred, viciousness, and cruelty. We don't want to off the pig so much as we want to off piggishness. Righteous rage, just anger. We've come to destroy the real origins of the horror we live in. Individualist property, selfish values, hateful concepts, and to save the people. We are the nightmares of the bourgeoisie come to life in their own homes as their own children. When I was a kid in Chicago, there were street gangs with beautiful names. Bel-Airs, Top Hats, Vicejoys, Corner Lords, Cobras, original homegrown American experts in urban guerrilla warfare. Admittedly, they didn't have much consciousness, cultural or political. But one of these, Blackstone Rangers, largest and toughest of the black gangs, has developed into a revolutionary force of the First Order. And another group, the Young Patriots from uptown Chicago, came out of the same gang war and blackboard jungle scene to found the Patriot Party. Street gangs and cycle gangs are two spontaneous and thoroughly American social developments, natural forms in American society, and we should use these forms. Or not use these forms, be them. Discipline is organic and pressure from the peers. Emphasis is on street reality and autonomous local control. Politics are a function of community love, neighborhood beauty. Shit on polemics. Shit on protest. The gang is a national tradition given a new direction, a little piece of Americana intertheorized. And much, much more in the same vein. Harry interviews a grown-up. Harry, July 1970. Harry went to interview Sam Jones, self-styled adult, at his office in downtown Baltimore where he works. We found Sam friendly and articulate, eager to explain the strange and little-understood cult which is now so much in the news. He was dressed in the colorful attire typical of Baltimore grown-ups, blue shirt, blue suit, blue tie, blue socks, and brown shoes. We proceeded to ask him some questions about the life and beliefs of an adult, why they dress and act the way they do, and what they are trying to say in this changing world. Harry, I believe you refer to each other as Mr. Sam Jones. Well, no, not exactly. Adult men call each other Mr. Ladies are referred to as Miss or Mrs., depending on whether or not they're married.
Married?
Marriage is a ceremony very common among adults, where a female adult swears to love and obey a male adult for the rest of her life. After such a ceremony is completed, the two of them live together.
Just the two of them?
Yes, at least until they have children. Anyway, these two are then supposed to have, sexual relations only with each other.
Really? This really happens?
Well, frankly, male adults are permitted, in a de facto sort of way, to have relationships outside the marriage. The female adults never do.
Oh, far out. Do your thing, as you adults say. But don't the women, how do you say it, broads, ever object to such treatment?
Never.
Well, Mr. Jones, how did you happen to become an adult? Did you have an abnormal background? I mean, did you come from a commune that had broken up, or a collective rent by political dissension?
No, nothing like that. I came from a very ordinary family. My mother belonged to a wandering tribe of yogi mystics, and my father was a Mexican cocaine smuggler.
Well, how do they feel about your lifestyle?
I don't see my father very often. When I do, we hardly speak. I feel bad about this. He's a vigorous old man whom I admire in many ways. Right now, he's fighting with a guerrilla band in the hills outside Indianapolis. I have to admire the way he sticks to his beliefs, even though these are very different from my own, from my subcultures.
Could you go into that?
Well, you often hear that we adults are in favor of wars. My father used to call me a war creep and a butch ignorant slob. We're not really for wars. We only support wars that are for really worthy causes, such as imperialistic conquest, exploitation of third world resources, and aggrandizement of the military-industrial complex. Honestly, we don't want great big wars. We can conquer, exploit, and aggrandize with little bitty wars. Really, we can. Just tiny little wars that no one would mind.
How about your mother?
She's adjusted better to my living the way I want to. She complains about my hair and dress. Son, she says, a grown man shouldn't cut the hair off his head like that. It's not healthy.
Just what influenced you to become an adult?
It was when I was at college. The family didn't want me to go to college, but for some reason I insisted. I used to sneak out and buy copies of the Saturday Evening Post.
Isn't that one of those adult magazines?
Yes, and the family was always angry when they caught me with it, said it was sexist and racist, reactionary smut. Anyway, it talked a lot about college in there, and I wanted to go. After a while, they said, all right. I wanted to go to Brigham Young or Whittier, but they wouldn't let me do that. It was Berkeley or nothing, and they wouldn't let me work my way through.
So you went to Berkeley?
Yes, and it was there that I fell in with adults, young adults. There were lots of people around like my family, the kind I'd grown up with. But young adults were something new, a whole different world, a world I've never experienced. Materialism, sexual hang-ups, the Republican Party, uncomfortable clothes, engagement rings, car accidents, Pat Boone, competition, patriotism, cheating, lying, ranch houses, TV, and suicide. I was dazzled. Pretty soon I was drinking beer, eating meat, and acquiring possessions. I've lived that way ever since.
Author's note. Beer is one of a number of drugs commonly used by adults, which contains the narcotic alcohol. Alcohol, known in its various forms as booze, suds, juice, etc., has been proven to cause liver and kidney damage and to result in serious character deterioration. Studies have also shown that alcohol usage often leads to indulgence in other harmful drugs such as tranquilizers, sleeping pills, caffeine, and tobacco. Perhaps you could give us some specific details about adult life. What about fucking, for instance? Do adults fuck?
You're not going to use my name.
No, this is all confidential.
Adults don't fuck. We have sexual intercourse.
You talk about fucking?
No, I mean we fuck, but we always call it sexual intercourse. It's different than fucking. The sexual activities of adults are different than those of other people. For one thing, adults often don't have any sexual activities at all.
Oh, wow.
Those adults who do have sexual activity have it with a member of the opposite sex on Sunday night in a dark room, male superior position.
That's disgusting.
I know. We try not to think about it.
Do you have any other disgusting sexual practices?
Young adults sometimes kiss.
On the lips?
They're not supposed to.
Tell us something about what adults do. We hear you talk a lot about work. As best as I can understand it, work consists of doing something you don't want to do 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. Could you fill us in as to why you spend all that time doing things you don't want to do?
We work in order to get money, which is, among ourselves, a universal medium of trade, something like dope.
I've heard a lot about money, even seen some, but I've never actually had any. Is there any way you can smoke it?
No. Money has a strictly metaphysical importance to us.
How do you work to obtain money?
We look around for someone who will give us a lot of things for a little money.
What kind of things?
Any kind of things. Then we find someone else to whom we can give a few of these things for a lot of money.
You do this with perfect strangers?
Yes.
Mr. Jones, what do you mean to express? What is the message of adulthood?
The message of adulthood is that message of Christian love which we adults have preached for centuries. That 30 pieces of silver was a good price in its day, but times have changed.
Editorial from The Bummer Issue. Harry, August 1971. Author's note.
What people forget about the hippie period is how serious it was. The clowning was all freighted with earnest concerns. We were terribly solemn about our frivolity. But, looking through back issues of Harry, I noticed sometimes even we got sick of us. We longed to indulge every now and then in plain stupidity instead of the deep, metaphysical kind. It would be very difficult to postulate any meaningful order in the universe as a whole. One can, of course, ascertain various regular tendencies for certain things to blow up and other things to collapse. But at the molecular level, this apple pie order breaks down into an atomic game of chance, quantum physics according to Hoyle. Many have attempted to refute this principle by quoting Albert Einstein's remark, "God did not shoot dice with the universe." But they neglect to include his next sentence. He did, however, play a fair hand of gin rummy. Frankly, scientific evidence cannot be ignored. And the scientific evidence instructs us conclusively that Earth and its inhabitants enjoy that class of relationship to the cosmic whole which we formerly reserved for red ants and two-headed brine shrimp. These facts might be taken as an imperative to seek understanding of the universe in mystic terms, but world religious leaders, acknowledged experts in the mystic terms field, agree that this is not possible. Archbishop Fulton Sheen has repeatedly stated that, unless you happen to win at bingo, there's really nothing we can do for you. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the Indian meditation magnate, warns, you can believe this stuff if you want to, but it won't do you a fat lot of good when payday rolls around. Though there have been holdouts on this mystic terms question. Notable among these was incomprehensible positive life force advocate Albert Camus, until he drove his expensive sports car into a tree at 120 miles an hour. Another dissident was Lee Ann Belworthy, a retarded girl from Fall Bend, Kansas, who was accidentally eaten by pigs. Despite Karl Marx's deathbed confusion that he was just kidding, some thinkers have attempted to find a rationale, or at least a poor excuse, for existence in the social intercourse of mankind. Suffice it to say, very little comment is needed on that endeavor. Other philosophers, such as Walt Disney, Marlon Perkins, and Sheila McRae, have turned to the animal kingdom in an attempt to establish a suitable role for mankind. Comparative zoological studies have proven that several other primates have, in the past, evolved to man's level of sophistication. However, they all committed ritual suicide shortly thereafter. The porpoise, closest in intelligence to man of any surviving mammal, was interviewed with particular thoroughness. It was discovered, among other things, that the porpoise is none too bright. Below is part of a transcribed panel discussion with Henry Blank, a porpoise from the Catalina area. Zoologist. Henry, could you tell us something of the average porpoise level of education and vocational training? Henry.
We're dumb. Can't read or write or nothing. Yep, dumb.
Well, what does a normal porpoise do on an ordinary day? How do you spend your time?
Oh, we just swim around and around and bump into things.
Could you tell us something about the porpoise philosophy of life?
Yep, shitty deal.
But better than nothing, right?
No. Lots of times we just swim right into boat propellers on purpose. But most of the time we just swim around and around and bump into things.
Emotional bonds have also come to the fore as a metaphysical raison d'etre, as has hedonistic pleasure-seeking. Liver trouble and bad breath have been advanced as virtually airtight refutations of such romantic and neo-Epicurean arguments. As Bertrand Russell points out in Principia Mathematica, fucking would be all right except women smell bad and slobber. Edna St. Vincent Millay has noted the same characteristics in other sexes. Taking the Train, in Three Acts, by the Penn Central Players. Chesapeake Weekly Review, June 1970. Author's note. In 1970, Dennis Boyles, a friend of mine from graduate school, started a second underground newspaper in Baltimore. Dennis called his periodical the Chesapeake Weekly Review of Literature and the Arts. It was pretty much indistinguishable from Harry, except that it was full of insane aesthetic views instead of lunatic political ideas. I said to Dennis, "How can you give your paper a name like that? It's Cornball. It's Squaresville." And Dennis said to me, 25 years from now, your curriculum vitae will say, "Writer for Harry," and mine will say, "Editor of the Chesapeake Weekly Review of Literature and the Arts." For his first issue, Dennis convinced me to go to New York by train and review the ride as experimental theater. I don't know why. Act 1. In the Station. I was surprised by the ordinary and modern atmosphere of the first set. Penn Central indulges in ironic play with the idea that trains no longer exist in their traditional form. They're making the point that railroad as a form of environmental art is in decay. Thus, there were no red caps, no garbled train calls, and little bustle in the station. The New York troupe, I understand, is more interested in cultural nostalgia and provides such things. The station scene was mostly well cast and beautifully sleazy in a current sort of sleaze. I have, however, some detailed criticism. Not to be picayune, but detailing in productions like this is very important. The food at the lunch counter was too good. This lent a note and left a taste of unreality which then pervaded the whole act. But the woman behind the lunch counter was perfect, old, fat, made up in disgusting manner, with moles and warts and things, and affecting a violent, phlegmy cough. I asked her if there were any French fries.
"Hell no," she said. "Don't wish that on me."
The crowd scene in the station was not exactly right. There were too few nuns and soldiers for my taste, and too many affluent-looking businessmen parts. I couldn't see any purpose in this. It didn't make a statement. However, the obligatory mass of seedy types, dubious in age, sex, and origin, was fascinating, oblivious yet unavoidable. These were so well played, so understated, that I don't remember the face of a single one. The train was on time. A clever surprise, I thought. Act 2, by far the longest of the three acts, is the ride itself. This has a certain intentional boredom and audience fatigue a la Warhol. I found even less attention to detail here and less authentic effect. This is a fault only because I felt throughout that authentic effect, with the exception of the scenery, was being sought. None of the errors within the train could be excused as concept play. The train was too clean, the bathrooms lacked that special smell, and sound effects were poor. No clickety-clack was in evidence, though there was an excellent, continual annoying squeak. Passengers in my car were too well-groomed and their performance forced. The small talk and development of interpersonal relationships were banal. A boy and girl met, very unconvincingly. The conductor made a pass at two women seated in front of me, but their conversation was unmemorable and their acting horrid. One of the women, especially, was completely distracted and unable to relate to her part. I thought for a while she was reading cue cards in her lap. I was disappointed by the whole waste of potential. Here was an opportunity for the playwright to have engaged in vigorous audience participation, but he avoided it as though he suffered from some aesthetic schizophrenia, so that while possessing a radical theatrical concept, he was unable to conceive of it except in traditional terms of distance from his audience. The sets, outside the train, were truly first-rate and constructed with a sense of humor. The scenery was completely hyperbolic. The city scenes were a tangle of artistically arranged garbage, slums, and industrial confusion, each a parody of the real item. No garbage is that profuse, no slums are that squalid, no factory is that dirty and disorganized. Credits aren't provided, but this work is very like Robert Rauschenberg's. From the slums, kids waved and played happily in the open fire hydrants, a satire on the down-and-out-with-happy-feet kind of 1930s movie. The garbage was stereotypic trash, beer cans, Wrigley's Juicy Fruit, and Baby Ruth wrappers, empty Lucky Strike packs, and rusted-out 53 Buicks. The set designer placed countryside between New York and Baltimore, where there is none. The grass was day-glow green, and the cows were made of plaster. It looked like the farm exhibit at the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry. The freight yards were incredible, too. The open cars contained beautiful freight, scrap glass and rusted metal in David Smith forms. All the train crews were young men dressed in sport clothes, models for a Sears Roebuck catalog. Whoever cast and directed the show did not work closely with his set designer. The director, of course, had the great opportunity to shape the total effect of the performance, but he got carried away with understatement. He wanted to express not only the decay of the railroad act, but also the idea that reality violates preconceptions. This is all very valid, but in this case, very dull, too. The sets were better theater than the performance. Act 3 is a birth metaphor. The actors and audience rise together and are expelled traumatically into the Penn Station set. This act is short, all fluid rapid movement, and superbly choreographed. I was left with no time for aesthetic or self-conscious reflection. Yet the unity and spirit of this human rush were so positive that I felt no confusion. Move, 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 move. That was really the end. Leaving the audience within a massive and grotesque environmental sculpture, New York, which cost an additional $9.75 to return from. Poems. Author's note. It was also through the good offices of Dennis Boyles that I became a published poet, more or less. Dennis convinced Bob Cobbing, an actual poet who ran a small press in England, to print Nancy Adler poems, Writers Forum Quarto, No. 11, London, 1970. Later, when Dennis was running a small press of his own, he published a second booklet, Our Friend the Vowel, Stonehouse, Baltimore, 1975. These poems require some explanation, but at this late date, I'm not sure I can give one. The form or genre in which I was working was called concrete poetry. It originated in the late 1940s and early 1950s with the works of Eugene Gumringer in Switzerland, Carlo Belloli in Italy, Irvin Fallström in Sweden, and a number of other oddly named people in places such as Iceland and Sao Paulo. Fallström wrote a manifesto of concrete poetry called, seriously, Manifest for Concrete Poesie. The idea was to combine the visual arts with literature to make something that you can't read and that isn't easy to look at either. Concrete poetry had a brief vogue in the 60s, and then, mercifully for all concerned, petered out. Examining my own contributions to the field, I would say that as a poet, I had talent in the graphic arts, and as a graphic artist, I was quite the poet. The Truth About the 60s and Other Fiction. The generation did not jive with the calendar any better than it agreed with its parents. When I say the 60s, I mean the years from about 1965 to about 1973, a period roughly congruent with the Vietnam draft, in case anyone's still wondering why the kids were acting weird. It was an era of great self-interest. Everyone involved in the 60s was fascinated by his own involvement, and many of us remained so long after hipness had collapsed into disco. I spent 7 or 8 years trying to write stories based on my experiences in the previous 7 or 8 years. The result was, I think, supposed to be a novel. I had an idea that these short stories would somehow get together on their own, perhaps while I was drinking at Elaine's, and arrange themselves into a plot. They failed to do so. In 1978, I became the editor of National Lampoon. I published the stories there because I was the editor, and no one could stop me. An Inquiry into the Nature of Good and Evil. I was living in a middle-sized city on the eastern seaboard in 1971, and for 2 years my best friends and I had been putting out a bi-monthly newspaper called the Community Underground Press. It's interesting that we had the word underground on the banner. I can't remember what we thought this meant. The paper was, of course, sold openly. And though the police did raid the old row house that served as our home and office, it was illegal drugs that brought them there, not publishing. The underground was a matter, I believe, of self-dramatization, the one undeniable talent of my generation. There were 4 of us who had been on the staff since the newspaper's inception: myself, Bob Vincent, Barry Handler, and Corey Harrison. We spent almost all our time together, partly working, but mostly sitting around, lying around, driving around, and talking constantly all day and all night, as only very young people can, about everything that can be imagined,
which is to say about nothing that can be recalled. Sometimes we even, though not for carnal purposes, slept all together in the same bed, and we shared everything we owned and a number of things that didn't belong to us. The paper itself was owned, if that verb can be applied to something that consisted of $10,000 in bad debts by Bob. He'd been raised in the city's Italian slums, had put himself through college, gotten a good job, married, settled down, and then had thrown it all over, job, wife, and every possession, to become a hippie. He was a happy, plump, kindly person. Even the narcotics detectives were fond of him, and would wave hello from their unmarked cars. Bob styled himself publisher, meaning that he took some concern with if and how our publication could be sold, or at least given away, and whether and when we'd pay the rent. I called myself editor, meaning I did not take any concern with those things. I was very politically minded in those days, and spent most of my energy trying to think up new ways to call for the overthrow of organized government by some people whom I called the people. It's hard to remember images that are not connected to real events, but I believe I saw these people as a couple of put-upon Negroes, some earnest college students, and one housewife with a nascent political sensibility, a group, come to think of it, not too different from the Carter administration of today. More important to our daily, that is, twice monthly, operation were Barry and Corey. Barry was a no-account rich kid, a couple of years older than Bob and me, who had been kicked out of several colleges and the Marine Corps. He was a professional photographer, supposedly, but really supported by an allowance from his family in Chicago. He wasn't a bad photographer, but he was lazy, and this particular city was not a venue for professional photography careers. The Community Underground Press, however, was a place where Barry could print whatever he wanted to photograph, and in return he did everything he could to make sure it continued to publish. Barry was more of a bum than a hippie or a radical. He preferred beer to dope and sex to socioeconomic discussions. And he couldn't be made to care much about politics beyond saying that election to office should be a felony crime. In fact, he sometimes claimed he didn't give a shit about anything except naked women. Our acquaintances thought him square, but we never goaded Barry for his lack of ridiculous clothes or social conscience. He had a sharper wit than we did, and, besides, he always had a few extra dollars, which we did not, and his car usually worked. The car was important, because Corey would take it and drive around the city and actually do some work. Corey was our only staff member with any real journalistic capacity. For the rest of us, the newspaper was an easier thing to have than a job, or a more concrete societal mission than might actually land us in jail. But Corey took the Community Underground Press quite seriously. She was the daughter of the city's preeminent, not to say only, left-wing lawyer. He was a man of substance with an extensive corporate practice who had seen the light, or hit his head on something sharp a couple of years before, and had abandoned his lucrative partnership to right legal wrongs, protect the poor from the depredations of capitalism, defend draft dodgers, and, I think, annoy his wife. Mrs. Harrison was mystified not at all by what her husband was doing, but by the speech, dress, manners, and hygiene of the people he chose to do it with. She did not understand, she said, why it was necessary to have horrible mores in order to promote laudable morals. Mrs. Harrison and I had several sharp conversations about Corey staying overnight at the newspaper office. Corey had been only 16 when she started working on the paper, and Mrs. Harrison had had every reason to be concerned. But I was a friend of her husband, and Corey was very stubborn, with me as well as her mother, about coming and going as she pleased. Eventually, Mrs. Harrison conceded the issue and treated me thereafter with every kindness. I could never stand the woman. Looking back on it, I would say she was the only person of my then acquaintance who was wholly in her right mind. That summer, Corey spent every day interviewing people or getting descriptions of things. Be-ins, teach-ins, love-ins, sit-ins, nude, semi-nude, and completely clothed encounter groups, crafts festivals, music festivals, and festivals for which there was no apparent purpose, riots, demonstrations, and squabbles of every kind, and the innumerable cliques of pothead communards. She covered, indeed, the motley gamut of social experiments that had spread across the nation with the same speed
and nearly as dreadful result as the Spanish influenza of some 50 years before. She was, by the lights of the time, a diligent career woman, and she was a formidable thinker for a person of her years. Corey loved theories, especially theories of